there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. FM. Here in New York City. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. The recalcitrant WBAI. Recalcitrant? Recalcitrant is somebody who is stubbornly resistant to authority. You know, it comes from the Latin to be disobedient, to kick back. Recalcitrant. Yep, so here we are at WBAI because they refuse to just say, we'll just follow all the rules and we'll present the news to you as the news should be presented to you to support our troops wherever they are, not WBAI. We won't do that. What we do is bring you information that is fabulous. We bring you education, information like the program we just listened to with Natalie. Fabulous information. Just love to receive that kind of stuff. Today we are going to be talking to you about fear, something new about fear, something different about fear. And we're going to use as our entry point you and your dentist. Yep, you and your dentist. What relationship do you have with your dentist? You know, a majority of people out there, over 85%, dislike going to the dentist. Dislike. They don't see it as a regular thing. You know, you go to your doctor, you go to your dentist, like you go to your average, get a checkup, you know, and say, no, the dentist. Why the dentist? And you're going to find from your relationship or the way you feel about your dentist, you're going to learn a lot about yourself today. Because, I mean, I had to examine this because I'm going to see a dentist. And I said, oh, well, what is this funny feeling I have? And I thought about it. And as usual, I took that and handed it over, and we wound up with some very interesting research about it. What is odontophobia? Here's a word for you, huh? Which is either fear of teeth or fear of a dentist. And who cares about this? Because all you care about is how to keep your boyfriend loving you. Well, believe it or not, the more you understand about everything, the more love you're going to have in your life. Yep, more understanding. So here it comes. Here comes a little more. People who hate dentists. I grew up hating dentists. I hated the dentist. Hated the dentist. So I had to examine why did I have this hatred towards a dentist. And new neuropsychiatry is giving us a chance to understand and learn about how all of this association happens between the dentist and pain or negative or aversion, you know. When I was a kid, I went to a dentist. I remember this dentist very well. I was very young. We went to the dentist. And I remember he betrayed you all the time. He lied to you. This won't hurt. This will only pinch. This was this and this was that. And it was a lie. And it was trauma after trauma. So is it the trauma associated with a dentist who lied to me that makes me have a fear of dentists? No, I took it a step deeper as I would. And no, the real person I was angry with was the people who brought me. My parents who brought me to this dentist and told me to behave and told me that my feelings were invalid. And told me that, so the real betrayal went beyond the dentist. So it's not just fear of dentist is about dentistry. No, it goes even further back. A lot of our fears go back to betrayal by our parents. You know, things that happen that we have associated somehow with our parents. This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind. But teeth, specifically teeth, are a very important part of your body because did you ever notice, I mean, some people you have all kinds of feeling about your teeth. Sometimes you think they're ugly. Sometimes you have to make them whiter and whiter. This latest craze, which is to make the teeth as white as possible, where they're taking these dyes and this stuff and putting it on your teeth, supposedly not harmful, but giving people the whitest possible, polish it down, shine it, spit shine your teeth, make them absolutely whitest possible thing. What is it? What is this about teeth? What does it do? You know, when you buy a horse, one of the things you do is check its teeth. And that tells you about the health of a horse. It tells you about the age of a horse, too. One of the reasons that people have such a strange relationship with their teeth is because teeth become a permanent part of your body as you get older. When you get older, as a child, you can replace teeth. You know, you lose baby teeth, new teeth come back. As an adult, every lost tooth going from the molars forward, you know, when you lose a tooth, it means you've gotten a little older. Your gums didn't support it. Now, nowadays, of course, through the magic of science, you can now replace teeth, replace them right into the bone, make them as new. I mean, make it like, it's amazing what they've been able to do. But there is something about that. What is it about your mouth? What is it about your teeth? What is it about the sign of your teeth, the power of your teeth? What if you can no longer chew things and you can only chew mushy food? Does that make you feel older? Does it make you feel like you're a little more fragile? Do people ignore it a little at a time? How about this one? And I wonder what the psychiatric word is for bad breath. Well, not just halitosis. I'm talking about that kind of organic, inside-the-stomach kind of thing where people have, it just seems like it's related. Well, I'm talking about some pretty disgusting things here because every time you talk about teeth or halitosis, people just want to not hear the conversation. But it's just science, my friend. It's more of science. What doctors do you like to go to? Which ones do you like to go to? Which ones don't you like to go to? Well, you're going to find that the ones you have the biggest aversion to are the ones that have an association with physical pain. So dentistry is associated with physical pain. So is getting a mammogram. You know, that's, I mean, one of the most painful things that happen to humans. And it's kind of a brutal system. You know, that mesh system is going to be the way we're going to find out you're okay. There must be a better way, and they're developing better ways. Gynecological exams in general could be very painful, especially since you're in such a vulnerable position when it's happening. You know, it's not like, here, look at my arm, you know, and tell me how my arm is. This is where you could barely see what's going on, and somebody prods in such a way that you have this sharp pain going through your body, and you feel betrayed and you can't move because there's an instrument inside you. You know, that's terrible stuff. As well as other things, you know, when every time a man goes to a doctor, he should, and I don't think they do it anymore, but he gets a proctological exam, which is where a man puts on a glove, or the doctor puts on a glove and going through your rectum, examines your prostate. It's a painful process. It hurts. It's painful associated. So people, what we've learned is that people who can associate pain with a benign anything, give me any kind of stimulus, give me, what was that? Michael, there we go. Give me any kind of stimulus, and that's what begins to happen. When a person associates a pain with a stimulus, so for example, it's easy to become conditioned to experience fear or even develop a phobia. You can get conditioned to develop a phobia or virtually anything by repeatedly exposing a person to a neutral stimulus. Now, a neutral stimulus could be a dentist, a person, a doctor. And pairing the neutral stimulus with an unconditioned, unpredictable pain. If you knew exactly how much pain there was going to be, all right, this is going to hurt on a 4 on a scale of 1 to 10, you might be able to tolerate it. That's the white knuckling. You do that when you lift weights. You know, when you exercise, there's pain. But you have a controllable level of pain. It doesn't stop you. It doesn't create an aversion. But when you have an unpredictable, uncontrollable level of pain associated with something that could be a neutral stimulus, then it becomes an aversion. For example, if somebody was forcing you to exercise or forcing you to do sit-ups or push-ups, like they do in the military as a kind of a punishment, then you begin to fear the actual exercise itself. do it often enough and do it, for example, with a neutral dentist who, dentists have just more and more ways of making you numb, but there's going to be pain. If you're sensitive, the pain is going to get through. And you change the wiring in your brain. Now, this is what we've learned from a group, a field of psychiatry called neuroplasticity, neuroscience, which includes neuroplasticity. Your brain will associate pain with the stimulus, and therefore it will want to avoid it. And I had the funniest thing when it came to dentists. I always forget where my dentist was. For as long as I could remember, for all, and I'm saying all my life, up until last year, I would forget where my dentist was. What street were they on? What was the block they were in? It's such an amazing thing. But that's one of the tools of the mind. In fact, get this one. I have my dentist currently is on the 9th floor of the building on which I'm on the 11th floor. And sometimes I get off on the 8th floor going to my dentist. I miss the floor. The mind gets that condition, and then it looks to undo it. Now, here's what happens over time. If you have a bad conditioning, a pain conditioning associated with something, this is called fear conditioning. The brain takes as little as one bad encounter to change the wiring in your brain forever. You can have your brain associated with, like, a clap of thunder could mean an electric shock from being struck by lightning, and from then on, clap of thunder makes you feel bad. You see, if you hear a siren, or if you hear a car screech, and if your dog got killed by a car when you were young and it was meaningful to you, that car screech will always be associated with pain in some way. So there are things that are associated with pain, and many of you have prejudices. For example, there are things that you hate, and you don't know that you hate them, and you avoid them, and you don't want to go near them because they are associated to pain. But since you avoid them, you never get a chance to know what you're avoiding. You don't know what the pain is. For example, I know a man who is afraid of pipes. No, he's afraid of mustaches. That was it. He had a reaction to mustaches. He had such a reaction to mustaches. Now, get this. Every time he saw anybody who was from the Middle East, where wearing a mustache was like the way to be, he had fear of them. Fear. Turned out, his father had a mustache, and his father beat him. He blocked that out of his mind. Now he had a prejudice against every Iraqi, Iranian, Palestinian, anybody, you know, Assyrians, everybody who wore mustaches. So in our mind, we associate pain with a neutral stimulus because, you know, Assyrians, they're great. How could you be? But they had the mustache, and the mustache is associated with pain, and that's the way it is. I'll bet you all of you out there have some avoidance or phobia that if you examine the phobia, you would find there was a pain association to it. And it's very funny. You have to find it. You'll have to look for it. You'll have to search it. It will not be a direct link because it'll just be two things happening at the same time. You go to the dentist, you get this electric shock pain because the dentist hit a nerve and didn't warn you, and that's it. You've made this association. So now you have a fear of dentists. Now there's that special smell that dentists have, which is like clove-like stuff that they used to put on your gums. There's a smell of a dentist's office. People get on the elevator after being with the dentist, and you could smell them. You know they were with a dentist. And I know people who have fear reactions from people who smell from the dentist's office. That's how simple our brains are, and how amazing the human brain is, because there's just the opposite. You see, whatever is conditioned can be unconditioned. And I could teach you how to do that if you have a fear. This is Armand DeMille living this life of exploration with you, with the positive mind. Fear conditioning can happen fast, and it's long-lasting. And for as long as you avoid the stimulus that's associated with the fear and bury it under layers and layers of disguise, right? So, for example, you go from your father used to beat you to you hate everybody who's got mustache to you hate Iranian music. you know? So then you hate Iranian hats, you know, and then the hats are all red, which they're not, and you hate the color red, and so you get buried under layers and layers of layers where your fear is sitting in the original layer, but you just can't tell it because you're going around people telling people you hate the color red. This is Armand DeMille with you. So fear conditioning. Now there's extinction learning. I want you to learn about that. It sounds like bad news, and it is bad news. Extinction learning, in rats, for example, conditioned fear response to a tone paired with a foot shock rapidly disappear when the tone is presented in the absence of the shock. So if you have extinction would be you go to a dentist and you get pleasure. Now, Martha Beck, a very interesting person who does what's a thing called the four-day win. That's what it's called. Martha Beck says, whenever you've got any conditioning and you want to change the conditioning, you need 4 days to do it a little differently. So let's say you had a fear of dentists. Do you know one of the ways they would recondition you? They would have you go for 4 days or four times to the dentist's office, and you would sit in the lobby and you would read a book. Go back four times, and then the fifth time, maybe you'll see the dentist, and you'll see him for a consultation. So you can uncondition yourself. You can take away the panic and the fear. There are so many people who run into dentist's office and right away want gas and anesthesia, and they want everything else to avoid remembering how deep the pain was when they were little. But you see, it's not the same thing. You could extinct it. You could get rid of it by having a positive experience. So here are some of the things you could do. You could do reward learning. Now, reward learning is a powerful mechanism. Rewards are like you go to a dental office and somebody gives you something, and they have it. Did you ever notice in a dentist office, of all things, they have a bunch of candy there for you? You know, they give you a little thing that you could take with you, little toys for kids, stuff like that, associations which are reward learning. And it's meant that you should have a good time, that we have to undo. Dentists know they have to undo this fear. Now, this becomes really interesting. Even though reward learning is thought to happen in the same part of the brain as fear conditioning, get this, reward learning and fear conditioning both take place primarily in the amygdala, this little part of the brain. And they have totally separate circuits. So there's the good stuff and the bad stuff, right? You could have a reward associated with dentistry, and you could have a negative thing associated with dentistry. What happens is those circuits get crossed. And what might have been pleasure becomes associated with pain. And from what they're learning, that people who are masochistic or tend to like pain tend to be the result of being in cross-circuitry. That they crossed the circuits somehow, that they had pain on one side associated with pleasure on the other side. The point is that memories formed during reward learning can provide a powerful counterpart of coexisting memories that may be related to pain as well. So you could have pleasure and pain connected together. Give you an example. We knew of somebody who grew up very sick as a child, sick in a very painful, I think it was cystic fibrosis, wasn't it? What he would do in order to just distract himself from it is he would masturbate. And he masturbated whenever he had this severe pain, he would masturbate. And what eventually did he associate? Pain and pleasure got associated together. They got crossed in the wiring. This, pick out anything positive about a dental appointment, for example, and relive it, replay it in your mind, and you could associate it with something good as well as with something bad. But some of the rewiring in the brain during fear conditioning, some of that stuff, when you have fear associated with anything, could easily be crossed over into some kind of a fetish or a phobia or something like that. Whatever we do that's strange, whatever we do that's unusual, is understandable if you dig far enough, you find it. You find it. You may not. It just may not make sense that the smell of ozone, you know, could be associated with electric shock. But we know it can be. You know, there's a smell of ozone in the air before an electric storm. Then comes an electric storm. Then you might have gotten shocked by an electric storm. So wherever you smell ozone, you have a panicky kind of feeling on the inside. But if you look. If you look at everything you're afraid of, and I know many of you have these fears, my friends, you can dig and you can find the association. Now, finding the association doesn't mean you get over it, because then you got to work on it somewhat. So, let me just tell you that there was a, I want to go back just for a moment on this. Personality factors related to emotion and cognition can influence the development of this kind of anxiety, especially around dentists. And I want to go to this one about dentists because I tell you, you learn a lot about yourself from the things you fear the most. A dentist is someone who can encourage in you a number of feelings. They could be nice to you and pleasant to you, and they could treat you well. A dentist, I think the mistake that all dentists make is they minimize the pain. I think they should tell you how much pain you're going to have. On a scale of 1 to 10, if they say to you when they give you an injection, you're just going to feel a pinch. What if they told you, well, this pinch is going to hurt, but it's going to be only a pinch, limited. It's going to be limited, but it's going to hurt. And hope you could take it, and they gave it to you. Right? What's going to happen? You're going to tense up before they give it to you so you don't feel as much pain, but so what? Then you're okay with them. Instead, they tell you, nah, relax, you're not going to feel anything, and you get wide open, and you become trusting, and they give you this injection, and you go through the roof, and then you don't trust them for the rest of the time. You're sitting in that chair, you're a nervous wreck. Whatever they tell you, you don't want to hear. Why don't they just tell you the truth as best they can? Look, I want you to relax. This is going to hurt, but I want you to try to relax as best possible. What we're about to do may hurt you, and I think it will hurt you on a scale of 1 to 10, like it'll get as high as an 8, but no higher. And if it gets any higher than that, you just raise your hand, and I will stop doing whatever I'm doing. Where are these guys? You know? They must be there somewhere. But those are pretty sensitive people. People who have had somebody be sensitive with them in the past. So in the idea here, my friend, is to try to in some way deal with all of your fears, no matter what your fears are. If you have a fear, you want to kind of deal with it and identify it. Remember, fear reactions. How do you know if you have a fear? Let's look at fear reactions. Heart palpitations, sweating, shaking, sensations of shortness of breath, chest pain, nausea, feeling dizzy, numbness or tingling, fear of losing control or going crazy. Now, these are kind of fear reactions. What do? Keep in mind that when you see yourself having a fear reaction, you say to yourself, I'm having a fear reaction. And what's interesting about it is the reaction is not the fear. The reaction and fear are not the same thing, because the reaction is telling you that there is real danger, but there is no danger. Once you learn to identify fear reaction and separate it from the actual fear itself, you begin to reinterpret what the sensation is telling you. Oh yeah, when I was a kid, I used to have this fear. I used to have this tremendous fear every time I went to a dentist, you know? Or every time I went to a doctor, I had this tremendous fear. But if you could in some way recondition your mind to say, I have the symptoms of fear, but not the fear itself. I have the symptoms of fear, but there's nothing to be afraid of. In 1962, two psychologists by the name of Schachner and Singer introduced what they called the misattribution of fear theory. Misattribution. It's a very exciting theory. The premise of it is that it examined the origin of fear from a novel approach. Fear was presumed to be the response to or the result of an emotional stimulus. For example, you see a vicious tiger, it triggers fear, triggers physical response. Nothing unusual about that. But they asked a question, this Schachter and Singer. They said, what if it wasn't the instigating agent of the physical symptoms? What if emotional experience was actually the result of the preceding physical signs? Therefore, if you could block the physical symptoms, you would eliminate the fear. So if a person did not feel fear beforehand, if they were numb beforehand, right, would they have this fear reaction? And that's what they found by their testing. They found by numbing people, people did not develop a fear reaction because they dealt with the physiology of it. So it's not you have a physiological thing, then you have an emotional reaction, and then you have fear. No, it's more directly related to the physiological reaction itself. If you take a painkiller and you're on a painkiller and then something strikes you or hits you in a way that would make you afraid in the future, you know, if you're on a painkiller, you don't feel it. Misattribution. It's not you're attributing the fear to anything in particular. You're just numb. So what we're learning from that is that fear can be changed so easily. And what I ask all of you to do is to look at your fears and see where they come from, where they originated, and how long you've been listening to them, and where are the sources. And maybe today I'll help you look at that. When we get back from our break, we're going to take your phone calls, and I want to look at your fears, and we'll talk about your fears and see if we could find something nice to be able to relate to it, because let's think about it for a moment. If you have a terrible fear, and you keep it very private and you don't tell anybody, then it stays hidden inside you, and it's like this little toxic thing that's always working on you. But if you could tell me, Armand DeMille, about your fear and put it on a table and have with it a positive experience, then we've reduced your fear automatically. That's why when you go to a dentist, if you're afraid, tell the dentist you're afraid. Tell him I'm afraid. I really feel worried about the pain. If the dentist makes fun of you, get another dentist. If the dentist says, I can certainly understand and I perfectly empathize with you, thank you for telling me, it's a different story. Telephone number here is 212-209-2900. We're going to take our calls after we take a short break. What do we need for people today? We need to give people something good for their hearts, which we're going to do. And then when we come back, we'll continue along with your phone calls. This is Armand DeMille with you as a Positive Mind. We'll take a short break. Be back with you very soon. Michael. Well, anyway, maybe that was just a tiny bit too early to take a short break. It is 1:29 here at WBAI. Hey, 1:29 here at WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. Play a little music and we'll be right back. Déjame hacer una conversión. 30.000 grados centígrados. Júpiter, el núcleo. En la atmósfera superior, las temperaturas oscilan entre 161 grados bajo cero a 200 grados bajo cero. That's the Gotan project with Chet Baker, believe it or not. Doing Round Midnight. Fascinating that you hear Round Midnight on an accordion. It's one of those things, you know, I mean, you always hear Round Midnight, you think of trumpet. You put accordion in there, and at first you go, what are they doing? And then after a while you listen and you say, well, that works. There are so many things that work, my friends, that you don't even know they work if you're willing to take a chance and give it a try. I know people who open a book, and before they even get to it, they junk it. You know, they look at a movie title, they junk the movie title. It's like the decisions are so quick that you could put away, you could do away with so many things. But how do you know what your decision is based on? Sometimes the decision is just based on fear. And sometimes you have a latent fear that is making your choice, and you think you're just making, oh, a simple choice. 212-209-2900. I wanted to speak to you about your specific fears, and I was going to give you a chance to call in and speak with me about it. 212-209-2900 here on WBAI. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Let's hear from you. Hi, this is Armand DeMille. You're on the air. Hi there. We'll get a call up in a minute. 212-209-2900.
Hey, Armand.
Yes, I'm there.
Yeah, I really wanted to get through on this one.
Good, you are through.
Great. I have a low threshold to pain, and I don't know if that's always accounted for. And also, I have this thing which I call medication mouth. You know how we talk about meth mouth? I was on psychiatric stuff for many years, and your mouth gets dry.
Yes.
And that decreases salivation, increases the proliferation of bacteria, and therefore I have lost a lot of my molars. And I feel like, you know, I've been sort of victimized by mainstream medicine in a sense. And you go into the dentist and you want to explain that to them, but at the same time, that's not their fault on one level. And how much information do they need, you know?
Well, wait, what do you mean you want to explain? What do you want to explain to them, that your mouth gets very dry?
No. It's not dry anymore. I've been off that stuff for a decade, thankfully. But explain to them why I'm missing so many teeth. It wasn't of necessity negligence on my part of oral hygiene.
Well, let me ask you something about the teeth as you've lost them over time, right? So you're saying that you think people look at your teeth and say he's missing teeth because he neglected himself. And you're saying, I didn't neglect myself. I was just a drug addict. And through that, I wound up with a condition that wound up taking
I wasn't a drug addict. I was given psychiatric medication.
All right, so I was taking psychiatric medication, and that resulted in me losing my teeth. It's important to you that people who look at you perceive you as not being, what, sloppy, being lazy?
Well, I will say, you can't see it from, the front teeth are pretty much intact. It's something that a dentist can only see for the most part. So it's not an aesthetic thing per se. Okay.
So you feel embarrassed in front of dentists.
Right. I feel like, you know, this guy must have been very thoughtful, must have had sugar 24/7, and that's not the point. So then I have to go into, well, you know, I was taking psychiatric meds and I had dry mouth as a side effect from the medication. So therefore, I have to explain that. Sometimes.
Okay. So now here's my hypothesis. Here's what I was talking about.
And they're not interested for the most part.
Well, here's my hypothesis. You see. My theory is that whenever you fixate on anything, like you fixate on the dentist here and how they, whether they care or not, you said a very big thing. They're not interested. Now I'm going to ask you to take that back over time. And I want you to tell me, as a kid, who was interested in you ever?
An uncle who is long deceased, who was a surrogate father figure.
So, Uncle, what's his name, Uncle what?
Felix.
Uncle Felix. And he was a beautiful guy, right?
Beyond.
Beyond beautiful. He saved your life.
I would say so.
Yeah. What do you carry that belonged to Uncle Felix?
Just wonderful memories. I have no object. I have no artifact.
Not a single artifact.
I can tell you a great memory, though.
But tell me a great memory.
When he was dying of cancer, he died of cancer in 69, he had me one time scratch his back because he had, you know, discomfort and side effects from the treatments he was getting. And my mother was in his house at the time, and she thought I would feel like a little ookie as a kid doing something like that. Nothing could be remote, further from the truth. I felt like this was something I want to say payback. I felt love, a reciprocity of love for the things that he did for me, and I was there scratching his back as like a token gesture on some level of love, a reciprocity of alleviating his discomfort.
What a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and that's a memory I carry with me, you know. But can I say one more thing related to the...
No, I want to go back one more second for you.
Sure.
So what we have with you is a traumatic experience of related to people who don't really care about you, and what you have in this case, and this is what the point I'm proving, the real people who didn't care about you, the truth is your parents. They didn't pay enough attention, neither mom nor your dad, I'm sure you may probably, but neither one. Uncle Felix did. And since that's the case, he couldn't care less, is a very important experience of your life. Every time you see somebody who looks at you and treats you like you don't exist, you get angry. But the reason you get angry is because you have this original anger you're carrying around. They couldn't care less. What a terrible way to grow up, and I know most people grew up that way, with parents who really couldn't care less about anything but themselves. But you had that too, and what I'm saying to you is when you go to the dentist, and when you go to people who you think are judging you, remind yourself, these are not my judges, because it's really not them who don't care about me. You know, it's the original pain that didn't care about me, with the exception of Uncle Felix, who is a pretty fabulous character.
Indeed. And I was just talking to his daughter yesterday. She's here from California, and I mentioned this very incident just yesterday. Talk about serendipity, and she had some tears coming into her eyes, and we shared a beautiful little moment here.
Pretty marvelous man. What's your name?
Austin, you know me.
Austin, I do know you. Austin, how nice. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Armand. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Bye. 212-209-2900 is the number here. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Armand. This is Robert. How are you?
Hello, Robert.
I probably have a fear that most people have, and I get anxiety attacks when I have to speak in front of a small group of people. And my business is I'm a salesman, and I have to speak in front of people. And I do it. I get through it. But I'm not the same speaker. I'm not as comfortable speaking with the family or a friend, and I would like to have that kind of flow when I'm speaking in front of a group of people, but I no matter how I practice, no matter how I prepare for the speech, I still get anxiety attacks.
Sure. So there's an association of something negative associated with talking to small groups or small crowds. So let me take you back in time. How were you as a little kid in school when you had to do the class presentation? Did you have that kind of fear then?
Well, I was gregarious growing up. I'm the first of six children. And I remember as a kid, we would have show and tell in third grade. And, I mean, I loved it. And I remember that I brought in this little toy of mine. I said it was my favorite toy, and I described it, and I had to stand up in front of the class, and I was fine with that. The other memory I have, and I don't know if this plays a part, but when I went to school, we had a timeout box. It was sort of like a voting booth, and if you misbehave, you had to go stand in this voting booth. And I was punished, and I had to go stand in this voting booth. And then the drapes opened, and the teacher put a little girl in there. And I was completely, I don't know, I think that was my first anxiety attack that I could ever remember. I don't know how that relates to...
So they put a little girl in there while you were in the room?
Yes, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know why, but...
But there was a panic.
There was a panic attack. And
how old were you at the time?
I could have been six.
Yeah.
Six or seven?
I'm going to take you back a little further in time, okay? And I think you're right. There is something about that was an association. We could probably go into that in some kind of length, but I want to go back a little further. You are the oldest of six children.
Correct.
As the elder of six children, you understand that there's very little time for your parents to pay particular attention to any one person, right?
Oh, yes, yes. I got most of the attention growing up because I was told that, you know, by my siblings.
You were told that you got most of the attention, but do you remember getting most of the attention?
No, I really don't. No.
That's an interesting thing now. Look at this, what we've just uncovered. Here you are, one kid who has a memory of having all his siblings saying, oh, everybody treated you special, and you don't remember being treated special because you want to know the truth, you weren't treated special. And what happened when you were a kid is you couldn't stand up and say, I need something. As the oldest of six children, it was unlike you to tell your parents you needed something. What you wanted to do is make their life easier. You took care of the other kids.
Right. That's exactly
and as
right.
a caretaker, you were somebody who never got taken care of himself.
And
so even though you got the attention because you were performing so well, because you were being a junior daddy or a junior mommy, you know?
Yes, yes, that's exactly right.
So as a little kid, you never stood up to your father or your mother and said, wait a minute, I need attention for me.
And to this day, you know, my dad is close to 70, I'm 49, my mom has passed 3 years. And my father will talk to me like I'm 8 years old. Like, he's bossy.
Yeah.
He rules with an iron fist. I mean, he's not a guy of a lot of words, you know. He demands. He doesn't command.
So if you were a little, if you want to know why, you have a phobia of standing up in public and talking to people, is because you don't know how to ask for anything. And what I would recommend... What I would recommend you do is two things, okay? One is, believe it or not, Toastmasters. Have you ever heard of Toastmasters?
It's an appliance, I think.
No, it's great. Toastmasters is a club, and it's a club that teaches people to give speeches when they have reluctance to do so. I have found more results from this than I have from any other system that works. So better than psychiatry, Toastmasters. Good reason. They have a good group of people. They really support each other. They do it in group. It's very inexpensive. You know? And it's called Toastmasters because what they hope you to do eventually is to be the person who could give the toast when the glass of champagne at a wedding and not feel nervous. But they get you to stand up and speak in front of small groups, in front of larger groups, and it's very effective. From what you're telling me about the damage from your childhood, this is going to be curative because you're going to be getting the kind of attention you need. The other thing I ask you to do is when you have a group of people in front of you, you want to ask them for something.
Yeah.
Ask them to give you something. Ask them, say, excuse me, could you just turn all of your pages upside down for a moment? Ask them to do something for you. Ask them to hand you their pencils. Ask them to be quiet with you for a minute. Ask for something that you could get from people, because this is what your skill is going to be. And most of all, I want to say to you, are you married?
I'm a single dad, and I have a seven-year-old son.
And do you have a mate in your life?
No. I haven't for quite some time.
Not for some time.
Yeah, about 6 years.
See, you haven't learned to ask a woman for help.
It's not something that I do.
Something that you did. You don't know what's going to happen today when you get off the phone.
No, that's.
You know, you're going to get off the phone today, and you're going to walk out, and there's going to be some woman standing there, and you're going to ask her for, can you give me directions? And there, everything will have changed.
Well, I don't really do anything to help my situation as far as having someone in my life, but
it would be interesting for a man like you. It would be very interesting for you to have some counseling with a therapist who is a woman who's somewhere in your field, you know, somewhere around your age range, somebody who knows about what you're doing. It would be a very interesting thing for you to do at this point in your life. It would help you open up more to a woman, and it would help you open up to asking for what you need.
Like a life coach?
No. No, like a psychotherapist.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Like that. Man.
Thanks for calling in. What's your name? Robert?
Robert, yes.
Robert, nice to talk to you.
Thank you for your time and your expertise.
Sure. 212-209-2900. So there it is, as we're saying. It goes back. And it has a root somewhere all the way back, but since we can't trace it because we don't have the skills to trace it, and in addition to that, there's a part of your mind that wants to blind you from the pain. It wants to take the pain away by not letting you see where the source is. So somebody like Robert will be a lonely man without a woman in his life, which he would like to have, because he doesn't want to challenge the fact that when he was a kid, nobody cared about him either. Really, except for what he did, which is bringing up the other kids, which is what he's doing now. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Armand DeMille, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi there.
Hi. Very interested in your program today. This is Ralph, by the way.
Hello, Ralph.
Hi, Armand. I'm interested in this program because, first, I don't have the realization of myself of having a fear of physical pain. And I was wondering if, like, how you would think, like, tattooing would figure into this, because that can be terrifically painful. I mean, really exquisitely painful. And yet, I have no fear of going and getting tattooed. And I was wondering if the fear of pain has to do with the longevity of pain after the event of that would give you the pain is over. In other words, if you get tattooed right immediately after stopping, you really don't have much pain. It feels like a light burn, where if you went for an operation or dentistry, like, the pain can exist for days and sometimes weeks afterwards. And I was wondering if that has part of it.
That seems to make a lot of sense, Ralph. You know, one of the things that I think you're talking about, too, is a thing called counterphobia. Now, counterphobia is where you're afraid of counters. No. Counterphobia is where, instead of being afraid of something, you jump into it. So, like if you're afraid of open spaces, you become a sky jumper, you become a paratrooper. If you're afraid of physical pain, you become somebody who opposes it by inducing it on yourself. Now, this is an interesting thing with tattoos, because tattoos give you both the wonderful identity of being able to decorate your skin the way you want to decorate it, plus it gives you this painful experience that also releases endorphins and other chemicals that make you feel pleasurable. Plus, if I, there are other rewards. Now, I imagine, you just tell me, you probably wouldn't get as tattooed if you were with a mate who didn't get hot from your tattoos. Do you have a mate who likes your tattoos?
Oh, yeah, she loves my tattoos.
Loves, like, with a big love?
It loves in a big love, in a sexual, in a very turned-on kind of a way. It's a very stimulating thing for her, yeah.
So, now let's talk about neuroplasticity and the mind. Here we have Ralph, who gets tattoos, and his girlfriend, wife, says, it makes me hot, and the more tattoos you get, the hotter I'm going to get. So there's a second association. You have a pleasurable association with it.
Right.
It's like if somebody had dental fear, you know, and they went to a dentist and they had a mate who said, oh, I can't wait to see the teeth when you're, you know, corrected. So that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So you're getting double things going on here. You're getting the association with the pain itself, which is an association, and you're probably a guy who is physically very strong and in some way numb, you know, kind of has a general numb feeling about yourself, so the pain makes you feel alive. The pain eventually releases endorphins, and then on top of it, it makes your mate climb all over you and slide all over you because she loves your tattoos.
Right.
Any particular tattoo that she loves the most?
I have a tattoo going across my chest that says strength. She is absolutely in love with that.
The word strength going across your chest is a tattoo.
Yeah, and it was one of the most painful tattoos I've ever gotten.
Well, someday we'll have to spend a little time with that. I thank you for calling in, Ralph.
Thank you, Armand.
Sure. 212-209-2900. Time for one more call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi there. Let's take one more call. You're on the air. Hello?
Oh, hello, Armand. Good topic.
Yes.
I'd like to tell you about my fear. I have a fear of confronting people, usually men, about when it comes to standing up for myself or my opinions about something.
What's your fear? What's your projection of what might happen?
Maybe a physical confrontation. I've never really had a fight in my life. And
Never had a fight. Uh-huh.
Nope, and I come off most of the time feeling like a damn coward.
Yeah. So you believe that if you had a confrontation with someone, you would get hurt in some kind of way?
Most likely, or end up looking like a fool.
Looking like a fool. So you have something. Did you always have this thing about looking like a fool?
Well, I always, you know, like to know what I'm talking about. I like to back myself up with, you know, concrete facts and things like that. So I kind of seem like I know.
So you have a fear of being embarrassed?
Not really. I think I have a lot of humility, and unlike the previous caller, I don't have a problem standing up and talking in front of a large crowd of people, you know? It's kind of
yeah, strange. So the main thing you have is fear of one-to-one confrontation with a man, and we're just about running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you something while I've got you here. Do you, how is it with your dad?
My dad, Most of the time we had a great relationship. We never really conflicted a lot. Maybe I wasn't too good for him all the time, you know. I wasn't good enough, but he was kind of like an absentee dad, I guess.
But you weren't good enough for him. Could you ever go to him and call him and say, Daddy, I need you. I need you to be here. Did you ever confront him that way?
No, but I think he would have done what he had to do to help me. If it came to that, definitely he would have been there for me. I know that.
I'm not so sure that you know that, because if you knew that for sure, I don't think you'd have the fear that you have. It's worth looking at, my friend, worth looking at.
Okay.
What's your name?
Robert.
Robert, another Robert. Thank you for calling in. We had five men calling in today. We're talking about fear, and five men call in. Amazing. Love the guys. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you. It's a positive mind. I'll be back with you Tuesday, al dente, at exactly 1 o'clock. If you want to get in touch with me, you can go through thepositivemind.com, thepositivemind.com, where they also show rebroadcasts of today's program.